A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hello, Herman and Corn. If you listen very carefully in the background, it probably won't come through in the audio that hits the podcast pipeline unless I went out to the balcony. But you can hear the sound of protesters with their drums. They're beating their drums and they're shouting some slogans against the government. And I have to say, I'm kind of alienated from this particular protest movement. It sprung up during the course of the war with Hamas in Gaza. And I guess, like a lot of people, my thoughts were, why are they protesting the government and not Hamas? They were basically saying the government isn't doing enough to bring the hostages home. That was kind of it. And then it now switched to after, you know, the hostage crisis ended, there was a ceasefire brought in. And now they're protesting the war with Iran, but that's even kind of stopped at the moment. And I'm not even sure at the moment what they're protesting, given that that's the case. I have made a mental note that the slogans and chants are often... I think it's fair to say that there is a gigantic overlap of people. And I know that it sounds like a harsh thing to call people professional protesters, but when you see people who are just showing up every single week outside your door on a Saturday evening to protest different things, it feels like they're just looking for the latest excuse to protest the government, and that it's genuinely some kind of weird hobby, that that's like the thing that they do. Now, here's where I'd love to get into an actual discussion, because the right to protest is enshrined in democracies, but there is equally a right for people living in city centres or wherever in the city to not have a demonstration on the only day, you know, there's in Jerusalem, there's one day per week where things are a bit quieter on the Shabbat. And now, over the course of the past year, I would say every single Saturday without fail, there's this weekly demonstration. And when it's outside your window, it's like loud. So I'd love to explore, Herman and Corn, places where there is political activity. You know, we could say that the right to protest government is part of democracy, but there's also a right to the quiet enjoyment of property. And I think that those rights, a general principle we see in democracy, whether it's a freedom of speech, is that we don't interpret rights as absolute rights. There's usually some limits to respect the rights of others. So it's a challenging balance, I think, to look at how we can have these respect both, and we don't end up living in societies where the government uses excuses to clamp down on protests. But I think this is a pretty genuine one. We've talked about how much noise pollution makes a difference from an environmental standpoint, and I think that protesting that is, you know, continuous over the course of years and doesn't even have a clear agenda genuinely falls under the category of it's a public nuisance. And honestly, I do feel like there should be some cooperation between, you know, whether it's protesters, the police, the people living in an area. It could be something as simple as like alternating the venue of the protest, so it's not outside the same places every week. But I feel like there has to be some thought put into it. What do we see in terms of maybe cities or fulcrums of political expression that have actually tackled this question more thoughtfully than others? Over to you two.
Daniel sent us this one, and I could hear the drums in the background of his message. He's watching these weekly Saturday protests outside his window in Jerusalem, and he's asking something that a lot of people I know have been chewing on privately, but don't always say out loud. When the same faces show up week after week, protesting whatever the issue of the moment happens to be. Hostages. The war with Iran. Now something he can't even quite pin down. It starts to feel less like a focused political movement and more like a standing reservation for outrage. His question is, How do you balance the right to protest with the right of people living nearby to quiet enjoyment of their homes? And are there places that have figured out this balance better than others?
Before we dig in, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today, so if anything comes out especially coherent, that's why.
Now, Daniel's not anti-protest. He's clear on that. What he's describing is something more specific, a protest that has become a permanent feature of the neighborhood soundscape, with a rotating cast of grievances with the same drums, same chants, same street corner, every single Saturday. And he's wondering whether that crosses a line from protected political expression into something closer to a public nuisance.
He's right that this isn't just a theoretical question. The tension he's describing between assembly rights and the rights of residents, that's one of those democratic fault lines that most countries handle through an accumulation of court rulings, municipal ordinances, and ad hoc police decisions, rather than through any clean constitutional principle. Supreme Court has a whole body of case law around what they call time, place, and manner restrictions. The basic idea is that governments can regulate when, where, and how protests happen as long as the restrictions are content neutral, meaning you're not targeting the message, you're targeting the noise level or the obstruction or the hour.
The city can say you can protest, but not at 3 a.m. with bullhorns outside a residential building.
The classic case is Ward versus Rock against racism from 1989. New York City required bands performing at the Nombard Bandshell in Central Park to use city-provided sound equipment and a city sound technician. The Supreme Court said that was fine. It was a valid time, place, and manner regulation. It didn't matter what music they were playing or what message they were sending. The city had a legitimate interest in controlling noise levels for the surrounding community.
That's the key phrase, legitimate interest. The question Daniel's really asking is whether a protest that runs every week for years, outside the same residential windows, with no clear endpoint or specific demand, still qualifies as the kind of protected expression that should override the legitimate interest of people who live there.
And here's where it gets genuinely complicated. If you look at the Israeli protest movement Daniel's describing, and he's talking about what people often call the Kaplan protests, though they've moved around, these started in early 2023 around judicial reform. Massive turnout, hundreds of thousands of people. Then October 7th happened and the focus shifted to the hostages. The Hostages and Missing Families Forum became a central organizing force. Then, after the hostage deal and the ceasefire, the energy shifted again to the war with Iran, and now it's somewhat diffuse.
Daniel's observation is that a lot of the same people have been showing up the whole time. Which raises the question, is this a series of distinct protest movements that happen to share personnel? Or is it one standing anti-government movement that adopts new banners as events provide them?
That's the uncomfortable question. And to be fair, the protesters would say, we're responding to an ongoing crisis of governance. The government that pushed judicial reform is the same government that managed the hostage negotiations and the same government that prosecuted the war with Iran. So from their perspective, it's not that they're changing the subject, it's that the subject has many chapters.
I think that argument has some weight, but it also runs into Daniel's practical experience, which is that when the chants and drums are outside your window every Saturday, you stop hearing the nuances of the political argument and just hear noise. And at some point, the persistence of the protest starts to undermine its own legitimacy with the very people whose support it might want.
There's actually research on this. Political scientists who study protest movements talk about something called the exhaustion effect. When protests become chronic rather than episodic, public sympathy tends to decline even among people who might agree with the underlying cause. A study out of the European Journal of Political Research a few years back looked at the Yellow Vest protests in France and found that support dropped significantly after about 3 months of weekly demonstrations, even controlling for people's views on the economic issues.
That makes intuitive sense. There's a difference between we are mobilizing because something urgent has happened and we are mobilized because we are always mobilized. The second one starts to feel like a lifestyle.
That's where Daniel's point about professional protesters lands. And I want to be careful with that term because it can be used to delegitimize genuine movements. But he's not wrong that in any sustained protest ecosystem, you develop a core of people for whom the protest itself becomes a primary social activity. They know the chants, they know the drum patterns, they know where to stand. It becomes community.
I've seen this up close. There's a kind of protest culture that develops its own rituals and social rewards. You see your friends, you feel part of something larger. You get the emotional release of collective chanting. And I'm not dismissing that. Humans need community. But when that community's chosen activity is making life unpleasant for their neighbors every week, something has gone wrong in the democratic calculus.
Let's get concrete. What do other places actually do about this? Because Daniel asks specifically, are there cities or countries that have tackled this balance more thoughtfully?
I was hoping you'd have examples.
Let's start with Germany. Germany has one of the more interesting frameworks I've seen. It's called the Versammlungsgesetz, the Assembly Act. It varies slightly by state now because of federal reforms. But the core principle is that protest organizers have to register with authorities in advance, and the authorities can impose conditions. Crucially, those conditions can include noise limits, time restrictions, and location changes, but they have to be proportionate and they can't be used to suppress the message.
They can say you can march, but not past the hospital.
And German courts have upheld restrictions on protest noise in residential areas, especially during evening hours and on Sundays and public holidays. The German Constitutional Court has a concept called practical concordance, praktische Konkordanz, which basically means that when constitutional rights collide, you have to find a solution that gives each right as much effect as possible, rather than letting one right completely trump the other.
That's an elegant framing. It's not assembly wins or quiet wins. It's that both rights have to be optimized together.
And in practice, that has meant things like protests near residential areas have to wrap up by 8. Sound amplification equipment has to be angled away from residential buildings. If a protest is going to be recurrent, weekly for an extended period, the authorities can require rotating locations.
That's exactly what Daniel suggested. A simple cooperation between protesters, police, and residents to just not be outside the same windows every single time.
It's not a radical idea. It's standard practice in a lot of European cities. In the United Kingdom, the police have the power under the Public Order Act to impose conditions on protests, including location and duration, if they reasonably believe the protest might cause serious disruption to the life of the community. That phrase, serious disruption to the life of the community, that's doing a lot of work, but it's precisely the kind of balancing test Daniel is asking about.
Though the UK has been going through its own version of this tension, there's been an ongoing debate about the weekly pro-Palestinian marches in London. Some of the same dynamics Daniel's describing, where regular large-scale protests in central London have raised questions about policing costs, disruption to businesses, and the impact on Jewish communities who feel the marches make certain areas no-go zones on Saturdays.
That's where the content neutrality piece gets tested. If you restrict a protest because of its message, because you don't like what they're saying, that's viewpoint discrimination, and it's unconstitutional in most democracies. But if you restrict it because of the cumulative noise burden on a residential neighborhood over 2 years of weekly demonstrations, that's analytically different. The challenge is making sure the restriction is actually about the noise and the duration, and not a pretext for suppressing dissent.
Which is exactly why the time, place, and manner framework matters. It forces the government to show that it's regulating the externality, not the message. And it forces the regulation to be the least restrictive means of addressing the legitimate interest.
Let me give you a specific case that illustrates how fine-grained this can get. In 2011, the European Court of Human Rights ruled on a case called Disk and Kesk versus Turkey. The applicants had been holding a press statement in Istanbul, and the police shut it down. The court found a violation of their assembly rights. But in its reasoning, it laid out the principle that authorities have a duty to protect the right to peaceful assembly while also protecting the rights of others. The key phrase was that restrictions have to be necessary in a democratic society.
Necessary in a democratic society. That's a high bar, but it's not an impossible one. The question is whether 2 years of weekly drumming outside the same residential windows meets it.
I think it probably does, but with important caveats. The duration matters. A one-off protest, even a loud one, is a temporary inconvenience that residents can reasonably be expected to tolerate. That's part of the social contract of living in a democracy, and especially in a capital city. But a permanent weekly protest is not a temporary inconvenience. It's a permanent change to the living conditions of that street.
It's worth noting, Jerusalem is not just any city. It's a city where Shabbat is culturally and legally significant. The one day of relative quiet is not a trivial feature of life there. It's one of the reasons people choose to live in Jerusalem rather than Tel Aviv. So, when the one quiet day becomes the regular protest day, that's a meaningful deprivation.
Here's where I want to complicate things a bit, because I think there's a version of this argument that gets weaponized. Authoritarian governments love to use noise complaints and public order laws to shut down dissent. You see this in Russia, in China, in Hungary. The government says, we're just maintaining public order, while effectively banning opposition protests. So the framework has to be robust enough to prevent that kind of abuse while still allowing genuine nuisance regulation.
That's the tightrope. And I think the key distinction is whether the regulation is prospective and general or retrospective and targeted. A city ordinance that says no amplified sound in residential areas after 9 p.m. applies to everyone. The protest, the wedding party, the construction crew. A police decision that says, this specific protest is too loud, shut it down, is much more vulnerable to abuse.
And that's why the best models I've seen involve clear, written rules that are negotiated in advance between protest organizers, municipal authorities, and resident representatives. There's a city in the Netherlands, Utrecht, that has a formal mediation process for recurring protests. Before a protest series can get a permit for multiple weeks, the organizers have to sit down with neighborhood representatives and agree on things like sound levels, end times, and location rotation.
Does that actually work?
The evidence is mixed, but mostly positive. A study by the University of Amsterdam's Conflict Studies Department looked at mediated protest agreements in Dutch cities between 2018 and 2023 and found that compliance was high, around 80% of the agreements held, and resident complaints dropped significantly compared to unmediated protests. The key variable was whether the protest organizers saw the residents as adversaries or as fellow citizens with legitimate interests.
That last point is crucial. If the protesters view the residents as collateral damage in a righteous cause, no procedural framework is going to fix the underlying problem. There has to be some baseline recognition that the people whose windows are rattling are also part of the polity, and their comfort matters too.
Conversely, if residents view the protesters as nothing more than a nuisance, they're not going to engage in good faith either. The mediation model only works if both sides acknowledge the legitimacy of the other's claim.
Which brings me back to Daniel's specific situation. He's not unsympathetic to the idea of protest. He's a politically engaged person. He's not saying, make it stop, I don't care about democracy. He's saying, this particular protest has become a permanent irritant with an unclear objective, and he feels like his quality of life is being treated as irrelevant.
I think that's a legitimate feeling. There's a concept in urban planning and environmental psychology called noise annoyance. It's a technical term, not just a complaint. Chronic noise exposure, even at moderate levels, has measurable effects on stress hormones, sleep quality, and cardiovascular health. The World Health Organization has guidelines on community noise, and while they're mostly focused on traffic and industrial noise, the principle applies. Persistent noise is a public health issue.
We talked about that in the Venice episode. The difference between steady-state boat noise and intermittent, unpredictable traffic noise. Protest noise, especially with drums and chanting, is highly intermittent and unpredictable. It's exactly the kind of noise that's most physiologically stressful.
And if it's every Saturday, the anticipation itself becomes a stressor. You know it's coming. You start dreading Friday evening because Saturday is protest day. That's a real psychological burden.
Let's talk about what a reasonable framework might look like, taking into account everything we've discussed. What would a thoughtful city do about a situation like the one Daniel is describing?
I think a thoughtful framework has maybe four or five components. First, advance registration, not for permission, but for coordination. If the police know a protest is happening, they can plan traffic management and noise enforcement. Second, default time limits that apply to everyone. Say, protests in residential areas can't use amplified sound after 8 p.m. and can't start before 9 a.m. Third, location rotation for recurring protests. If you're going to protest every week for months, you don't get to monopolize the same street corner every time. Fourth, a clear escalation mechanism for residents. If a protest is causing genuine disruption, residents should have somewhere to go, a municipal ombudsman or a mediation panel, that can hear their concerns and recommend adjustments without shutting down the protest entirely. And fifth, periodic review. If a protest has been running for more than, say, 3 months, the permit should come up for review, and the organizers should have to demonstrate that there's still a specific objective and that the protest is calibrated to achieve it.
That last one is interesting. The idea that the right to protest isn't just a right to make noise. It's a right to make noise in pursuit of a political objective. And if the objective becomes unclear, the justification weakens.
I want to be careful there because I don't think the state should be in the business of judging whether a protest has a sufficiently clear political objective. That's a content-based judgment, and it's exactly the kind of thing that gets abused. But I do think duration and frequency can be regulated without reference to content. A city could say, any public assembly that occurs more than 12 times in a 6-month period in the same location is subject to additional coordination requirements. That's content neutral. It applies to the weekly farmers market as much as to the political protest.
That's a clean approach. The regulation attaches to the frequency and location, not to the message.
And that's consistent with how most democracies handle other recurring uses of public space. If you want to run a weekly street fair, you need permits and you need to coordinate with neighbors. The fact that your event is political doesn't exempt you from the coordination. It just means the city can't deny the permit based on your politics.
Let's bring this back to Jerusalem specifically. The Saturday protests Daniel is describing, they've been happening in various forms since early 2023. That's over 3 years of weekly demonstrations. At what point does the cumulative burden on residents become a legitimate regulatory concern, even under the most speech-protective framework?
I think the honest answer is, we passed that point a while ago. And I don't say that to dismiss the protesters' concerns, many of which I share, frankly. But the right to protest is not a right to permanently occupy the auditory space of a residential neighborhood. That's not what the framers of any democratic constitution had in mind.
There's an irony here that's worth pointing out. One of the core arguments of the protest movement, going back to the judicial reform days, was about protecting democratic norms and institutions. But one of the norms of a functioning democracy is that political disputes get resolved through elections and legislation, not through permanent street mobilization. If the protest never ends, that's not a sign of democratic health. It's a sign that something in the normal political process has broken down.
Though the counterargument would be, the protests continue because the underlying problems haven't been resolved. The hostages came home, but the government that many protesters view as responsible for the failures of October 7th is still in power. The war with Iran happened, but the broader regional security questions remain unsettled. From the protesters' perspective, the issues are ongoing, so the protest should be ongoing.
That's a fair point. But it raises the question of what the protest is actually meant to achieve. If the goal was to bring the hostages home, that happened. If the goal was to change the government, there are elections for that. If the goal is to express generalized dissatisfaction, at what point does that expression become a permanent background condition rather than a mechanism for change?
This is where I think the protest movement has a strategic problem, not just a legal one. Protests work, when they work, by mobilizing public opinion to pressure decision makers. But if the protest becomes background noise, literally and figuratively, it stops pressuring anyone. People tune it out. It becomes the thing that happens on Saturday, like the trash collection or the street sweeper.
Daniel's already tuned it out in the political sense. He said he's alienated from it. And he's exactly the kind of person whose support the movement would want. Engaged, thoughtful, not reflexively hostile. But instead of persuading him, they've annoyed him.
There's a political science concept called the persuadable middle. The people who aren't firmly committed to either side of an issue and whose views can be shifted by events and arguments. Protests that alienate the persuadable middle are counterproductive, regardless of how righteous the cause is.
Noise is a great way to alienate people. It's visceral. You can't argue with it. You can't reason with it. It just happens to you, in your home, and you're powerless to stop it. That's not a recipe for winning hearts and minds.
Let me pivot slightly, because Daniel asked about places that have handled this thoughtfully, and I want to talk about one more example that I think is instructive. Australia. Specifically, the state of Victoria has a framework for managing protests that includes something called a neighborhood impact assessment for recurring events. If a protest is going to happen in the same location more than 6 times in a year, the organizers have to submit an assessment of how they'll mitigate noise, traffic, and other impacts on residents. It's not a veto. The city can't just say no, but it forces the organizers to think about the people who live there.
Which is itself a cultural shift. It moves the protesters from, "We are doing something important and you should tolerate the inconvenience," to, "We are doing something important and we have a responsibility to minimize the harm it causes to others."
And the Australian experience suggests that most protest organizers, when required to think about it, can come up with reasonable accommodations. They angle the speakers differently. They agree not to use drums after a certain hour. They rotate locations. None of these things prevent them from expressing their message.
Which suggests that the problem isn't really about the right to protest. It's about the unwillingness to acknowledge that other people's rights exist alongside it.
That unwillingness cuts both ways. There are residents who would use any regulation as a pretext to shut down protests entirely, just as there are protesters who would treat any accommodation as a betrayal of the cause. The democratic challenge is to design rules that work despite both of those impulses, rules that protect genuine dissent while recognizing that nobody has an unlimited right to impose themselves on their neighbors.
If we were advising a city, or if Daniel were talking to his municipal representatives, what's the practical takeaway here?
I'd say there are 3 or 4 concrete things that work. 1. Require advance notice for any protest above a certain size, and use that notice period to coordinate on noise levels and end times. 2. For protests that recur more than some threshold, say 8 times in a year in the same location, require location rotation or additional mitigation measures. 3. Establish a resident liaison process, so people who live in the area have a point of contact for complaints that isn't just calling the police. And 4. Enforce the rules even-handedly. If you have noise limits, enforce them against the protest, the same way you'd enforce them against a loud bar or a construction site.
That last one is important. Selective enforcement is how you get the worst of both worlds. The rules exist on paper, but they're only applied against disfavored groups, which both undermines the legitimacy of the rules and chills legitimate protest.
I think it's worth saying explicitly, none of this requires restricting the content of the protest. You can protest whatever you want. You can be as angry as you want. You can chant whatever slogans you want. The regulations we're talking about are about the externalities, the noise, the duration, the location, the frequency. Those are all content neutral.
Which brings us back to the core principle Daniel flagged at the start, that rights in a democracy are not absolute. Freedom of speech doesn't mean you can yell fire in a crowded theater. Freedom of assembly doesn't mean you can set up a permanent drum circle outside someone's bedroom window. The whole project of democratic law is figuring out where the boundaries are.
The boundaries move. What was acceptable in 1970 is not necessarily acceptable today, partly because we understand more about noise and health, and partly because the density of urban living has changed the baseline. When everyone lived on farms, a protest in the town square affected a handful of people for a few hours. When you have thousands of people living in apartment buildings along a protest route, the calculus is different.
I want to circle back to something Daniel said that I think is worth sitting with. He said he feels like the protests don't even have a clear agenda right now. And I think that's a real phenomenon. The protest that continues after its nominal objective has been achieved or has become irrelevant. It becomes a kind of ritualized opposition, where the point is the opposition itself rather than any specific change.
That's where the professional protester critique has some bite. Not because the people involved are paid, most of them aren't, but because the protest has become a profession in the sense of being a primary activity and identity. And when your identity is person who protests the government, you don't need a specific reason to protest. You just need the government to exist.
Which makes it very hard to negotiate with, because there's no demand that can be met. If the demand is, the government should resign, and the government doesn't resign, The protest continues. But if the government did resign, would the protest stop? Or would there be a new government to protest?
Historically, movements that become identity-based rather than issue-based tend to persist regardless of the political circumstances. You see this with some environmental movements, some nationalist movements, some religious movements. The movement becomes the point. And that's not necessarily illegitimate. People have a right to associate around shared values, but it does change the calculus for how society should regulate the externalities. A protest with a specific, achievable demand is a temporary disruption in service of a concrete goal. A protest that is an ongoing expression of identity is a permanent change to the urban environment.
Permanent changes to the urban environment should go through a different regulatory process. If you want to open a bar, you need a license, and you need to meet noise standards. If you want to run a weekly concert series, you need permits, and you need to coordinate with the neighborhood. The fact that your weekly event is political shouldn't exempt it from the coordination that other weekly events are subject to.
I think that's exactly right. And it's not a radical position. It's the position that most democratic legal systems have arrived at, even if they don't always enforce it consistently.
Daniel's instinct is basically correct. There is a genuine tension here. Most thoughtful democracies have developed frameworks for managing it, and those frameworks generally point toward coordination and mitigation, rather than either unrestricted protest or outright suppression. The question is whether Jerusalem, or Israel more broadly, has the institutional capacity and political will to implement something similar.
That's a harder question. Israel's protest culture is intense and deeply embedded. The judicial reform protests of early 2023 were some of the largest in the country's history. The hostage protests had enormous moral weight. Any attempt to regulate protest noise or location is going to be viewed through a political lens, regardless of how content neutral it is on paper.
Because in a polarized environment, everything is viewed through a political lens. The same noise regulation that seems reasonable to a resident who wants to read a book on Saturday afternoon seems like authoritarian suppression to a protester who believes the country is in existential crisis. And both perspectives are sincerely held.
Which is why process matters so much. If the police just show up one day and start handing out citations, that's going to inflame things. But if the city council holds hearings, hears from residents and protesters, and develops a framework that applies to everyone, including the Purim parade and the Jerusalem marathon and the weekly protest, that's harder to characterize as suppression.
It's worth noting, Daniel isn't asking for suppression. He's asking for cooperation. He specifically suggested alternating venues. That's a reasonable person trying to find a reasonable solution.
That's the democratic instinct. Not my right should trump yours, but how do we both get most of what we need? That's praktische Konkordanz, to borrow the German term. It's the recognition that we all have to live together, and the rules should reflect that.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The banana slug has a tooth-covered tongue called the radula, and it can have up to 27,000 teeth arranged in rows that it uses to scrape food off surfaces before eating.
27,000 teeth on a slug.
I'm going to be thinking about that for the rest of the day, and I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, thanks, Hilbert. So, here's where I land on Daniel's question. I think the right to protest is essential and non-negotiable in a democracy. I also think that a protest that runs every week for years outside the same residential windows has crossed from protected expression into public nuisance, and that reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions are appropriate. Not to silence the message, but to protect the people who have to live there. And I think the best models we've seen, from Germany to Australia, show that when you require protesters and residents to actually talk to each other, you can usually find accommodations that work for everyone.
I'd add, the fact that this is hard doesn't mean it's not worth doing. Democracies are built on the idea that people with conflicting interests can find ways to coexist. That's true of elections, it's true of legislation, and it's true of street politics. The protest isn't going away, and the residents aren't going away, so the only sustainable option is to figure out how they can share the space.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Back next week.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.